Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 227 already. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thank you for tuning in. Today's guest is one of my favourite people in the world and one of many requested return guests. It's Miss Kate Tempest. I've known Kate for years. She's like a sister to me. I love her dearly. I'm a fan of her work. We gigged together for years and years and years, and it's a funny one because as many of you know, I said for ages I don't really have return guests, and then in quite quick succession, I had PR people hit me up about Simon Pegg coming back on, and Kate Tempest coming back on, and both of them had come on long enough ago, and so much had happened in between that I was like 100% yes. And then it was beautiful to hear from the PR team that they were setting up all the press for Kate's new book, which I'll tell you about shortly. In fact, we'll talk about it a lot in the podcast, but they were setting up the press. And because it's a very personal release of poetry, she didn't want to do a lot of press. She kind of wanted to just let the work speak for itself and not kind of do the rounds as you do. And then they suggested my podcast, and she was like, yeah, I'll do Pips. So I think she did mine. She did some stuff with The Guardian or The Observer. And I'm not sure how long ago her podcast with James O'Brien was, but I've heard great things about that. So check that out as well. But yeah, this was all set around her new book, A Running Upon the Wires, which comes out on September 6th. So depending on when you listen to this, is either out tomorrow or out now. So I should mention that, as ever, we're brought to you by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com, a record label that almost actually released a Kate Tempest thing, because I did, we do a series on there called At Home With, and it started with At Home With Polar Bear, who me and Kate talk about in this episode, because the three of us toured together, and good mates, nothing but love for each other. So the first one was At Home With Polar Bear, and what happens is Polar Bear just sat down at home and recorded a load of his poems. He talked in between, he explained them, and then I was going to do a Tempest one at some point, and we've never quite got round to it, but we also did At Home With Rob Alton, and they're available. The Polar Bear one, the CDs have sold out, and they're always a limited thing, but the digital download is available still at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, and the Rob Alton one still has some CDs left and digital available at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. And we've just rejigged the website, so it should be easier to find everything. I've added some new signed stuff, so signed photos, DVDs, records, books, everything. As this is a podcast around a book, I should mention that my Times best-selling Distraction Pieces podcast book is available there, signed. And my graphic novel of poems, Poetry in Emotion, is available there as well. So head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and have a little look around. So it was great to get to sit down with Kate. I can't remember if we touched on it in the podcast or if we talked about it beforehand, but we used to meet up on the regular for old man drinks. Me, Kate and Pola would meet up and we'd just moan about stuff and be excited about stuff. And we've not done it in ages because everyone's lives just get busier and people move to different areas and stuff like that. So when this podcast came up, I was like, it saves us failing to arrange to hang out. So we just got to hang out, and that's what this is. And I hope you'll feel how friendly and how excited we were to see each other. I need to give a lot of thanks and love for the reaction to all the podcasts in recent weeks. The Spike Lee one in particular, and the Professor Green one, a lot of people didn't expect, I don't know why, but didn't expect Professor Green to be so intelligent and thoughtful and a well-spoken, amazing guest. I had example as well, recently was great, had some great stories of when he was signed by Mike Skinner, who's also been on the podcast in the past. Polar Bear, who me and Kate talk about a lot, has been on the podcast in the past. Obviously, yeah, we've had a load this year of great ones. We've had, in the past, I'm thinking more people that, if you're into Kate, you might be into. I've had Roots Maneuver on and Akala. Akala was an amazing guest, just giving a history lesson in the podcast. It was amazing. So check that out. Loads of good people, basically. So thank you for all the support and all the love. I'll get on with it, I guess. Next week, I've got Drew Pearce, who's a great director. The week after that, I've got one of the best podcasts I've ever recorded with Angel Guifria. I've forgotten already how to say her name. She taught me on the podcast. But she's an amazing young lady who's got a robotic arm. She kind of tongue-in-cheek self-identifies as a cyborg, but it's legit as well, because since 6 months old, she's had some kind of robotics that she's engaging with and working with. And yeah, it's amazing. It's a hell of a conversation. It's going to blow all of your minds. So check that out. And I also, as requested, I did get a chance to sit down with Sage Francis and B. Dolan on their recent Epic Beard Men tour. And I know that's one that a lot of you have been asking. I know, again, both of those guys have been on in the past, yet I was constantly getting messages of, are you going to get a chance to talk with Sage and B when they're in the country? So, yeah, I drove all the way to Cardiff to make sure I had that opportunity. And we sat up till about 2:33 a.m. recording this podcast. But you're gonna love it. So that's all to come. It should be Drew next week, Angel the week after, Sage and Dolan the week after that. The other thing I need to mention is a weird one. I've decided to try out a Patreon page. A lot of podcasters do it. A lot of you have been asking about it for a while. And nothing is going to change either way. I'll explain. I've set up a Patreon page. I guess it's patreon.com/ScroobiusPip, or go on there and search ScroobiusPip. And I've only got one tier, and that tier is $1 a month. I don't want any more from any of you. And what do you get for that $1 a month? Absolutely nothing. It may not be the most successful Patreon ever. I'll explain. In recent months, I've had some approaches from two of the biggest radio stations in the country to go over and work with them on a podcast and stuff like that. And I've turned them down because this podcast is the goal. This is it. This is what it's meant to be. You'll hear in this conversation with Kate Tempest the reason podcasting means so much to me and why it's not a stepping stone to a radio show or whatever else. But yeah, that kind of happening made me think, you know, I do all right off this. I have sponsors and that. It means it's a fluctuating thing. It means that some months it pays well, some months it pays very little. But yeah, I wanted to set this Patreon up for you guys to have an option to support this. I wanted to have only one tier, so all you can pledge is $1 a month, which is like 80p a month. So, because it occurred to me that regardless of the size of the guests, I've got a core listenership, and it's in the thousands. It's in the tens of thousands. And you guys are the ones who listen, regardless of how big the guest is. And that's what's important about this podcast to me. And I get a lot of requests of this guest or that guest. And at the moment, and for the last 4 years, the guests have been based on who's in town, who's near, who passes by. And my thought was, if there was a core of you who thought that $1 a month was worth, you know, the at least four episodes you get every week, if there was enough of you, I could travel to guests more, or I could pay for guests to come down. I could pay for their travel. I could pay for hotels. I could do all sorts of things and have that bit more freedom to go, look, we're going to make this work. It also keeps the pressure off of me to do the podcasts that are the best podcasts, not the podcasts that are the biggest names. Again, another thing that's happened recently, because of the success of the Michael Fassbender episodes, the Simon Pegg episodes, things like that, I'm getting offered some huge names, and I'm turning some down because they're people I'm just not into. Now, the temptation is always there to go, that person's got like 5 million followers on Twitter or 10 million followers on Twitter. That'd bring a lot of listeners in, But if I don't think they're the right guest, then they're not the right guest. And it also means that even when I've got a big guest, like Professor Green, for example, I don't have to try and chase salacious headline-grabbing content. I can talk to Pro Green about mental health and about depression and about the Dangerous Dogs Act and stuff that is genuinely of interest to me. And I'm doing all that anyway. That's kind of my point. There's no pressure here. There's no hard sell. But yeah, I wanted to give that option to for you guys, if you feel it's worth it, supporting creative freedom, I guess. You know, it will also support the writing I'm doing on scripts, on novels, on whatever else. You know, allowing me to create what I'm inspired to create rather than chase a dollar. And I do that anyway. So again, this is the worst sales pitch ever. But yeah, I might add some exclusive content on there every now and then, some videos or some chats or do some Q&A type things, or give some kind of first looks at merch and stuff like that over there. But that's not what I want to sell it on. I don't want to try and hard sell you. I don't want to make promises I can't keep. And I don't want to change anything for those who don't want to pledge. So yeah, it's there as an option. If you pledge $1 a month, I'm mentioning it on this episode because it's the first episode of the new month. You pledge $1 a month and it will just take it out each month and you won't notice. But again, if you think about it, if enough of you chose to do that, that's a substantial amount each month. I can pay Buddy Peacemore, who produces the podcast week in, week out. I pay him already. And again, it's one of them that he has a set rate. And that's why the idea of Patreon appeals to me, because my earnings go up and down off the podcast, depending on, as I said, how many sponsors I've got this month and so on and so forth. But the people I work with, I want them to have a set wage. I think that's the moral way to do things. So Buddy has a set wage each month. John, who does the videos online, has a set wage each month. Amy, who looks after the social media for speech development, has a set wage each month, regardless of what I'm earning, what gigs I'm doing, what live stuff, what merch is out, any of that. They've got their set wages. And this will allow me to maintain that and to potentially give them a bit more. And that's kind of the idea. I don't know if it'll work. I don't know. You might all hear this and go, nah, man, that sounds shit. But as I said, if you think about it, kind of 80p a month, you're not even going to notice. And I'm not going to have these tiers of £10 a month and you get this, or £20 a month you get this. I don't want that much off you. That's crazy. Netflix is like a fiver a month and you've got every film ever, or tons of TV shows. I ain't going to try and compete with that. But 80p a month, that's interesting. Anyway, that's all I need to tell you. Let's get on with the podcast. Episode 227 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Kate Tempest. Just gone straight into it. Even if my backup ain't rolling, I want to get the most time available. How are you doing, Kate Tempest?
I'm really good. Very happy to see you.
It's been a while, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been ages.
And it's lovely. And I was saying to Alice, who I was chatting to beforehand at the publishers, that you, me and Polar Bear, or you and Polar Bear are my two favourite people to catch up with, to just have a chat with. But we're also all, I've always really busy,
yeah,
and be really bad at scheduling stuff and sticking to schedules. So
yeah,
as soon as this request came in, I was like, well, yeah, I'll just, it's, it saves us having to organise a drink or anything else. We can just have a catch up. So it's lovely. But how's it all been? Are you in the throes of promo on your latest collection? And we'll get into all of this.
Like, it's pretty chilled. Like, I feel like at last, the powers that be who organise these kind of things for me,
yeah,
have like really heard me when I say I don't want to do like a million things. That, like, just, I feel like what we're doing is really exciting. Like talking to you, that's something,
yeah,
that's just great.
Yeah,
chilled,
yeah,
you're,
yeah,
my,
yeah,
mate. Like doing a few really interesting new ways of doing the promo bit,
rather, you know, than just churning out because, yeah, there's people who want to talk to you because you're Kate Tempest, not because of what this specific thing is about and things like that. Because,
yeah,
that is,
yeah,
the tough thing. I remember on album tours,
I talked my way out of question time two or three times because I wasn't an expert on what they were talking about. And yeah. It's one of them, just because I've got an album out,
yeah,
that seat should be filled by someone who knows about that subject, not someone who's got a loose opinion,
yeah,
who's then going to speak it loudly and articulately or whatever. It's exciting to get that control. Do you feel that's something you've had to fight to get over the years?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's, don't get me wrong, like, I'm over the moon to be doing this for a career, for a living. Like, and if people want to talk to me about my work, like, I feel dizzy with gratitude for that. It's amazing. Yeah. But the situation I've been in is that the last kind of four things that came out were all debuts. So there was a debut album, then there was a debut play, debut theatre show, debut album, debut novel, and debut poetry collection. So what happened was, for all of those different things, you've got to do all the press that you would do if you're a debut artist, which means you've just got to be everywhere, like talking to loads of people that are either really sycophantic or really condescending, or they don't really care about what you've got to say. They're just doing their job, which is like the way it works, and that's fine. But because now this is my second collection,
it feels
great. It feels really exciting, like, and the kind of knackering treadmill thing of it isn't really happening. So I don't mean to sit in here and complain about
tough
life for an artist, you know.
Do you feel as if you don't have to prove yourself as much on this time round? Because it is something. I think it's why me, you and Polar Bear always bonded, was we were the ones at the spoken word gigs often who hadn't necessarily gone to posh schools or had posh accents or whatever else. And it was always dope because we'd all relish in the fact that we were having people turn their nose up at us as we arrive. And pat us on the back as we leave and shake your hands and things like that. And we love that. But that can get exhausting as well, particularly in theatre and in literature and in music, to have to keep doing that, have to keep going, here's where I'm from, but I know what I'm talking about and I work hard at this.
Yeah, I think that you probably always have to prove yourself to yourself, really. And I think as I get further into my writing life, I need a little bit less reassurance from other people, and I need a lot more from my own, like, bar, where I set the bar, do you know what I mean? And I think that it's easy to say once you've had a bit of recognition that the recognition isn't important to you, because before I had the recognition, it's all I wanted. I couldn't sleep at night because I didn't think I didn't know how to get more recognition or bigger crowds or, like, bigger gigs or, like, get a record deal, all these things. Now I'm in a situation where I'm terrified about this book coming out because it's very new, but at the same time, I feel much more relaxed about it. So it's what it is. It's what I made. I feel really lucky that it's coming out, you know?
It's a great place to be in as well, when you can have that kind of the success was almost convincing yourself it was good.
Yeah.
You've done that bit. It's now nice if other people like it, but you've got to that point where you're like, I'm happy with this. Because I remember it was last a time we talked on this, it was a fascinating conversation to have because you were saying how interesting it had been putting together your first collection. It might have been on this, or it might have just been just casually, but interesting putting together your first collection, realising how different page poetry is to live poetry and to spoken word. And it's an interesting one because there was a thing a little while ago where there was a backlash to Holly McNeish's book, and I was nervous about reading the article because I heard this backlash, but I understand the point of view of there's a difference in spoken word to page poetry. I then read the article and it was written aggressively, horribly, personally. So I was completely on Holly's side, but I was nervous because I was like, I love Holly, but am I going to be like, well, yeah, there is a difference.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing to point out, but it was interesting talking to you and seeing you come to those realisations on your own. The fact that because you're a seasoned performer, there may be certain lines, and I will definitely have had it, there may be certain lines in stuff you've written that you're relying on the fact that you can deliver that with a venom. 100%. On the page, if the person reading it isn't the performer that you are, then that might fall short, and it makes you analyse it a bit more.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, writing for other people, writing for theatre, for actors, it really shows up a bad line, something that you'd get away with it because you wrote it and you're excited about it, or whatever, you say it, you hear an actor say it back to you, you're like, wow, I really need to try that one again and work a bit harder. But then with poems with like the page poetry, I used to think, oh, the only difference between a poem and a spoken word poem is that somebody is literally speaking it out loud. That's what I used to think.
And I've argued that in the past. I'm sure all of us have in the past, because particularly in those scenes, there was a snobbery towards spoken word. So we would argue vehemently, it's just out loud. But you're right and wrong in that. There's right and there's wrong in that.
I feel like these new poems are poems that don't belong in performance. Like I don't really think they're good. I'm not going to tour them. I'll do a launch, but I'm not going to go on a big tour with them because I don't think it's going to work in a big room. And I think the best way for people to read them, if they felt inclined to, is alone with the book. Mm. And that's the first time I feel like I've got my head around the form, the poetry book as a form. Do you know what I mean? It's definitely taken me a while to realise what the page can do that the stage can't, rather than just knowing what the stage can do that the page can't.
Of course.
It's cool. Like, you start thinking about the space around the poem and the brevity of it and all this stuff. And also like, pace. Because you're inflicting the pace when you're performing.
It's your rhythm, it's your meter.
And actually, people need to go at their own pace, especially with stuff like this, which is all about heartbreak, new love. You know, it's like, it feels like the kind of thing that I need to relinquish control of.
Yeah.
Because it's intimate.
Yeah.
So people need to have it intimately.
Well, that's it. It allows it to, the intimacy that you've allowed yourself to share then allows others to experience it in themselves, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's not being, because there is an amazing thing of watching a great performer perform this piece at you and you can connect to stuff, but there's still, you're on one side and the performer's on the other side. And with page poetry, it isn't. You are. It, even though it's not your words, if you relate to it, you've only ever heard it in your voice.
Yeah.
Because that's how we read. So it's a powerful thing.
We'll see how it goes. I want to know. So since last I've seen you, you've been doing these podcasts. They're going so well.
They're going all right.
If I was to ask you for a memorable moment from all of them that you've been doing, maybe like, not necessarily your favourite moment, but just something where you learnt something new, or
there's a key one where I learnt how important podcasts are, and I did a podcast in conjunction with Red Nose Day.
Right,
they'd set it up, and it was with Safe Housing for Women, a great charity in South London, just near Brixton Academy, and both of us are fans of South London. Yeah. And South London's in our hearts. It meant a lot. And I was speaking to a young lady called Mira who had been brought to this country in sex trafficking. And I said to her, look, you don't have to go into any detail. You can go into as much or as little as you want. It's not a grief porn kind of thing. You can go there. And she chose to go into a lot of detail. And, you know, her point was she's only just realised that she didn't do anything wrong here. Whoa. It was these horrible people. So it was this intense podcast. She cried, I cried. Everyone who listened to it cried. But when it came to being released, Red Nose Day didn't do a single post about it or push it. They stepped away from it. And I think it's because of the rawness of the story, the graphicness, the pain there. And it made me realise the importance of podcasts, because that story couldn't have been told in her words the way she wanted it told on the BBC or on ITV. It'd have to be edited or danced around or politely kind of moved about. But in censoring the victim, it implies some kind of guilt on the victim. If you're saying, you shouldn't, I mean, that's a bit much for it's like she hasn't done anything wrong. That's what happened. Yeah. It's the reality. So that was one for me where I was like, oh shit, this is important. And the other one was I did a birthday special a few years back where I sat down with my mum and dad separately and talked about them divorcing and separating, and me and my dad had never sat down and had that conversation. Whoa. I tried to write poems about it loads, like, it's all love, it was the best choice for them, but I tried to write poems about it for years, or raps or whatever else, and I realised that I was working in the wrong medium, and us sitting down and talking about it again, he was in tears, I was in tears, but it was the medium for this. It got across the horror at the time, but then also that it was the right choice, and it's better to grow up in two happy houses than one unhappy house. You know, the ridiculous taboos around the traditional or the thought of the traditional family setup is ignorant.
But it's kind of amazing. It's great if
it can be achieved, but it's not. You shouldn't restrict yourself or damage yourself because of that.
It's amazing that you to sit down and have a really structured conversation about something so. Or maybe difficult to address, like for you and your dad to sit down and be like, right, we're going to talk about this. That's
I think that was it. It's amazing. It's because I've done so many of these podcasts where people pour their hearts out, and then I get tons of praise for the openness of these podcasts, and I'm like, I just sat there and they were amazing. It's not me. So it was that kind of thing of turning it around. And one of the things that spawned the podcast in the first place was I sat down with again our mutual friend. Musa, and I interviewed him because I was writing a film idea, which now might become a two-person play thing, but film idea that was going to be about homosexuality, and I wanted to talk to Musa about him coming out and all of this. And I'd had numerous nights out with Musa and chatted to him, and I learned stuff in that conversation I would never have learned in my life, and it's why I'm always excited to have people who are my close friends on as well, because if we were to meet up in a pub, we'd catch up on the last a week or so. That's what people do.
We
wouldn't get into the tiny intricacies of everything else that's going on. So
it's cool,
it's fascinating. I love it as a platform and a medium, but there's a lot I want to talk to you about, but I'd normally kind of work through. My plan was to start kind of where we left the last podcast, because your novel was about to come out in Whitstable, and go to now. But I'm kind of excited, as we've already started speaking on your new collection, I want to kind of jump straight to that and we can go back to it, because I've read chunks of it. I've not read all of it, because you're probably the same. I like a physical thing in front of me. I've been sent a PDF and it's like, this is cool, I'm reading, but I need to lose myself in this. So, but what struck me was, as you said, the intimacy, how personal it is. And I think you've always, in fact, I'll turn it back on me. I've always written incredibly personally, but I've written through fictional narratives.
Yep.
So I've created a situation to pour my heart out, but I've got the safety of a character or a narrative I know isn't true, even if people are going to assume it's true, because I've woven it, but the emotions are in there. And your work has always been kind of similar to that. It'll always have a lot of references and history and stories and things like that. Instantly, as soon as I started reading this, it came to mind one of the first times I had you play my stage at Bestival, and you started a poem, and the opening line is just, let's spend the day in bed with a bottle of wine. I think that's the opening line. And you said after that, you said, if I was a braver poet, I would have ended it there. Because it's a beautiful poem. Just that, as a beautiful, heartfelt thing. And for some reason, that came to mind as I was reading these, because it was you not... Obviously, it's the way you write is always intricate and beautiful, but it felt that it was that bit rawer and direct and personal. So how has that been, taking that approach and going... Because again, it is about heartbreak and the moments after that and the moments further, the positive moments further after that and things like that, which is incredibly personal, right?
Yeah.
Well, are you talking about what you've been through personally, or are you kind of, how do you want
to? Well, I mean, I don't know yet. This is like the first one, to be honest. But like the what I think I can say to that is that this is the first time I've written in the first person.
Yeah.
So it is very different, and it is a new kind of reveal in some ways. All of my fiction and my theatrical work has been extremely revealing in some ways, but you have this this artifice, they call it, which is the structure and the narrative, and you've developed characters so that they may begin in a moment of lived truth, but they go on to become people that you know, experiences you've lived, something you've observed, suddenly they take shape, and they're not you anymore, so it's safe to go with them to the darkest parts of them or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But with this, you know, the poetry collection is, it begins at the end of a relationship, but rather than being like a breakup album, I thought it was a more useful thing to offer the world to stay with the speaker of these poems and to go through heartbreak, go through drunkenness and promiscuity and despair and kind of enter into the redemption of new love, and then even stay with it even further. So then you get domesticity and rowing and buying new sheets, and like the idea being that you don't often get that when you get people writing about love.
Yeah,
you get this the kind of romantic like despair of the breakup is what you get. So then people stay there; they think that's what it is, you know. Yeah. And you become attached to the feeling. You feel so much grief that you think that that's better for you than feeling positivity. There's all this stuff anyway that comes to mind when I think about how can what I'm making be useful?
Yeah,
because even if you're writing about yourself, especially for me, making the decision to write about myself, I didn't want it to be indulgent. But then I thought, well, the most truthful way I can tell this story is by writing the story. And it's like my marriage fell apart and it was really grim, and now I'm in love again, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And that is a massive thing that's been happening in my life over the last few years.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at. So when the deadline approaches for your next poetry book, that's the poems I've been writing. that's where I've been at.
Do you feel it's such an obvious question, but do you feel it's been cathartic and helpful to write about it, to document it? Because it is, I've said this numerous times, but I've genuinely had horrific things go on in life, or dramatic things go on in life, and just as I'm falling asleep, it genuinely has crossed my mind, I'll probably get some good poems out of this. Genuinely, it's the life of the artist, is that any good or bad is you're almost experiencing it for others. And again, it takes you a long way to get past that. It's why I love that I'm not writing musically at the moment, because I don't have any of that. It's just I'm not thinking, is that a good, should I note that down? So was it helpful and cathartic to kind of to turn tough times and turbulent times, or even just to turn your focus onto yourself?
More than that, what it is that it's to document the process of healing.
Yeah.
And the poems are themselves fragments of healing. Like this, it's useful. That's quite a useful thing. You say to someone, you know, it's going to get better. Everyone knows how it is to feel brokenhearted, but this is something people turn to poetry when feelings are very big.
Yeah.
So my dream for it is that somebody who is going through a difficult relationship, the end of something, falling in love with somebody when they are already with somebody else, whatever it is, like here is a book of poems where it's I, but that I can become you, hopefully, because I mean, I don't think it's gratuitous. It's like, it is intimate, but like, hopefully it's open and it's reaching out. I mean, I don't know as well. It's not out yet. So who knows? Right now I'm like, it's fine. Because no one's read it.
No one's seen it.
So it might be. The other thing is, like, I know what's coming after it. You know how it is when you put something out. Like, I know that there's an album that's coming afterwards. Yeah, yeah. And so I feel a bit safer about this because I see it as part of a constellation of new work. Like, it's one thing. It's the first step in some new work.
Completely.
I know what's going to happen after. And I know what's going to happen after that. So even if it's not to people's tastes, like I've done my time with it and I'm proud of it and I see where it fits in with the other stuff. Yeah. So it's like,
and that's a beautiful thing to have that kind of outlook on it, because, again, I've had that before with, say, a first single off a new record.
Yeah.
If it doesn't go down as well as you're expecting, there is that kind of, no, I know what's next. Honestly, just wait. It's all right. Honestly, this will make sense.
Yeah.
It's why sometimes it's better for big labels or whoever to have the choice over the order of these things like, because as artists, we're going, no, here's how it goes. Here's the story. This is the order. And they're going, but no, people don't know that that's coming, but you do. So it's a mad one. But I like about the kind of the structure and the vastness of the story that you're telling here is that, as you said, generally people will focus on one part of it, either the breakup or, if it's a rock and roll band or whatever, the promiscuous, isn't it fun being single bit in the middle, or the I'm madly in love bit. So it's great that you're covering all of them, so anyone in any of those situations can relate to the other. Do you know what I mean? If you're struggling in anything, but equally the importance of going past just the madly in love bit, because that's equally as important. I think people sometimes get tricked by romanticism and things like that, which is great. But the fact is, it doesn't remain that, or I mean, the honeymoon period type thing. It doesn't remain like that forever. It can remain brilliant forever, and it can be the right thing forever. But it might not remain that exact glow and.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's our responsibility as writers to then document the reality of what it means to love when you've been together a few years and you're finding new ways of feeling like this person is the most amazing person in the world, and it's got nothing to do with all that, like all the fireworks that happen at the beginning. Yeah. You know, like maybe that's our responsibility then. I don't know.
To continue to tell that. I love it. Well, let's rewind a bit and look at the big excited moments of debut album, because that couldn't have gone much better, mate. The album was amazing. It went down really well. The response was amazing. The tours were amazing. How was it to get that out there? Because I'd been... Obviously, I'd known you for ages, but I'd been a fan of spoken word and musically with Sound of Rum. But this was the first time you were Kate Tempest. Yeah. And knowing that you did grow up in love with literature and books, but you also grew up in love with beats and rhymes. Yeah. So it felt that there was a point that you were climbing and climbing and climbing as in the kind of more literary type world. And it's like, I know there's a bit that just wants to be up there rapping and not having the pressure of oh, well, the metaphor here was it's like, I just want to be up there. So it was that perfect. It all came together beautifully. So how was that?
It was amazing. Like, it was, I'd been desperately trying to find a way to express myself musically that felt, you know, that felt true and electric and all those things. And then we made this record, and it, like, I mean, I've been working in schools, teaching. I've been working for the Royal Shakespeare Company, as you say, all this very literary stuff. And I was just, like, chomping at the bit to do some rapping, you know?
Yeah.
And then the album came out, and, like, suddenly the dream of, like going on tour, like a tour, you know, like a headline tour. I came with you guys on supporting you guys, and I saw what happens when you... when you do a headline tour, but suddenly to be in a position, to have a record out and for people to be liking it and to be getting gigs and, it's just a feel tearful even.
It's amazing, because again, it's the beauty of writing a record that's true to yourself, so not just going, oh, how am I going to get commercial success? Writing a record that's true to you, it then means all the more when people do connect to it and it does have that success and there is those crowds building and building, because you've not courted that. It feels more personal because it is as stupid as it's like, they like me. Do you know what I mean? It is that, because you've not sat down and gone, how do I write a pop single? How do I make a hit? You've sat down and poured your heart out and written what you love.
Yeah.
So when other people love it, it's amazing. It's an extended feeling of when you're at a party and you meet that person who's into the same obscure artist that you're into, and you've never met anyone else who's like that, and you have that, I love that album, I love this, I love that, but in this instance, it's all of it, it's you, it's your...
Yeah, I think, like, when you're touring at that stage, and especially because I've been gigging for years and years and years and years, and, like, but to very small crowds, and, like, as you start to build them up and incrementally you're seeing, like, just, I don't know, 10 more people, 50 more people, 100 more people, like, you don't take a second of it for granted, because you're like, wow, it begins to happen, like, and it's been 10 years in the making, and suddenly it's like, wow, this is it. Like, there is actually 100 people in this room rather than 20, and, like, the next time you go back to that place, there's 150 people in that room or whatever it is, and, like, driving around, we start off in a... on the train, and then you maybe in a car, and then eventually you get a van, and then, like, you know, one day you're in a bus, you're in a tour bus, you've dreamed of your whole life. You know?
Some of the first gigs I saw of you guys were at festivals where you weren't invited to play. So it's exactly that. First of all, you're at a festival and no one's asked you to be there, and then you're on a small stage, and then you're on a bigger stage, and it is that mad excitement and journey, because you know that you would have been... or you were doing it even when you weren't asked to. Do you know what I mean? You were doing it because you needed to. So when people actually want you to and care for it, man, that means the world.
It's incredible. Things like Glastonbury and things like that. Yeah, for that, for those reasons, when, well, yeah, at any of the bigger gigs, we played Brixton Academy at the end of the last album campaign, and
how
that's
bad
huge.
Is that for you?
That's huge for me because so many gigs that I've seen, that's like the local big venue in South London. 100%. So that's where you go. I've stood outside it trying to get into things like since I was 14, you know.
It's where, honestly, I'd come in from Essex to go to 14 and 15 and be like scared to get out of Brixton because Brixton is like, it's rough. But it must have been amazing.
So
right?
It's those kind of moments when you're, because I'm sure it's the same for everybody in their lives, you know, you're just, you do get into that motion of like just getting through, you know, you're just one thing in front of the other and you're doing your best you can and everything. And then you have these taking stock moments, whether that's positive or negative things that happen. Suddenly you just take stock. And that was really one of them when suddenly I just thought like, blimey, we've been dreaming of this since we were like children, you know, and like, and because in my band who I play with, it's people that I've known since I was very young. We've been playing together since we were very young. We've been going to see gigs there together since we're, you know, it's all this stuff. Suddenly, my heart's beating fast even thinking about it. You just think to yourself, like, I can believe it's happening. It's here. Like, and it's like, it's this funny thing. It's like complete conviction and like crippling self-doubt all the time.
100%.
And like, when it is happening, it's almost a bit dangerous to acknowledge what's happening in case everything goes wrong. Suddenly you're like, oh my God, it's Brixton Academy. What if you have to just, I don't know. Sometimes you have to not take stock.
Yeah.
But you do have these moments.
I was going to say, I wonder if that's why it does take a break or whatever else to look back. Or even it can be someone else bringing it up or reminding you. Because it is, again, with someone like yourself who's gone from so many different disciplines and genres, there's not these gaps to go, this is wicked, isn't it?
That was a good year.
This is all right.
It's like, I can't stop. Can't even stop to think that. Like,
or that couldn't be more the case because the album came out and was going down a treat, and then you were darting off to mess about with Rick Rubin and with all sorts of people. It's like, there's no place to take stock there. So how was stuff like that to get to go, wow, here I am. Not only is the Brixton stuff in the works and all this, I'm out here with
Icons. It was like, I can't tell you, like, how surreal. Imagine going to, like... Okay, I'll break it down because I think it's safe to do that here. So, Rick Rubin, when I was doing Brand New Ancients, which was this long poem that I did in 2012 now, it's a long time ago now, and it managed to tour to New York. A theatre in New York saw it playing in Edinburgh, and they took it on for a week. And in the crowd one night was a producer from a TV show called Charlie something. He's really famous, like American talk show. I was knackered. I really didn't want to do this interview, but this producer had got in touch. He'd been in the audience, seen the show, and he'd said to someone from the theatre, we'd love to have Kate on to do this interview with this guy. So I go into this room with this really famous American like talk show host guy, but he's all in black. It's a black room. You're around this big stern wooden table. There's like cameras in the walls.
Wow.
Right. You can hear them in the walls like mice.
Yeah.
And he's like on this little headpiece, like talking quite sternly, like trying to get more coffee. But he's not talking. I'm sitting next to him.
Yeah.
But he's not looking at me. He's talking to the people in the walls.
No.
I was knackered, jet lagged, freaked out. I just thought, I don't want to do this. Anyway, I do this interview and I did a little bit of Brand New Ancients. And it just so happened that Rick Rubin, of all people, was watching this TV show that I was, you know, very like, I didn't want to do it. And then so I get home. And at the time, I was living in Camberwell, I think, at the time. And I just get a message from my agent being like, okay, so Rick Rubin wants to speak to you on the phone. I was like, what? And then he called me up. I was just on the sofa at home. He's just calling him from Malibu, you know, like. Anyway, so we began this communication like five years ago now. And we've been working. It's just mind-blowing. Like, what happened was he was interested in making something, but I wanted to continue doing things and setting up what we talked about, reliable groundwork fans you've earned. You don't want to go in at the top because it's over too soon. You know, like you want people to trust you, right? Yeah. So you want to do the legwork. So we kept in touch. He came to like a gig we did in Elephant and Castle at Corsica Studios, which is like underneath an archway in Elephant and Castle. And he just he just turned up because he was in London, I think, to go to like Kanye's wedding. But he came in and he left because it was like, obviously a bit shit. But like, I didn't know he was coming. And then anyway, but the reason I'm telling it is because what happened, which is interesting, is that he had this idea, right, for how he wanted an album to get made. And so we started making these demos. He was like, I don't want any drums. So me and Dan were like, I've been waiting all my life to work with a really amazing hip-hop producer. The first thing he says is, I don't want any drums.
Yeah, that's the opposite of what you're expecting from...
Then we're like, me and Dan are writing these, like, folk demos. Like, we're in...
Yeah.
what do we do? Like, and then we went to Shangri-La, which was his studio.
Yeah.
And it's like, white... There's not a speck of... It's so zen, it doesn't even have door handles on the doors. Brilliant. Like, you just have to intuitively know how to move through the space. You
can come in and out at any point.
It's just so bonkers. And there's, like, white bean bags and, like, a view of the Pacific. There's, like, grapefruit trees in the... It's like, you know, like, I am yet to ever experience anything like it.
Madness.
And we were in this this old tour bus. It had been Bob Dylan's tour bus, like, in the 60s. And it had... Because this Shangri-La studio, it's always been a studio, but it used to be owned by someone else. Anyway, Rick Rubin's taken it on, and it had this old tour bus that had parked up at the studio and broken down, never to be a tour bus again.
Right.
So they've turned that into a little studio. So we're in this, like, little studio looking at the Pacific Ocean, like, in Malibu, trying to write folk songs for Rick Rubin. We're like, this is bonkers. So every time we... are delivering demos, he can't tell us what he wants. He can only tell us that's not it.
Feeling it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we start writing Let Them Eat Chaos.
Yeah.
Basically trying to give Rick this album.
Right.
And it wasn't right for him, wasn't what he wanted. And we were like, well, we want to do this.
Yeah.
We want to do Let Them Eat Chaos. So we went back to Streatham and like we got in the studio and Let Them Eat Chaos started taking shape and we started getting really excited about it and we kind of put the Rick album aside or we gave that time to percolate.
Yeah.
Did the whole thing with Let Them Eat Chaos, still trying to make demos for Rick. And basically, 5 years later, we've now made the album. This album that he wanted us to make is now complete. We've just got to go and record it. It's written.
Amazing.
And that's coming out, hopefully, all being well, in the late spring next year.
That's mad,
isn't
right?
Isn't that mad? Like, so the whole Let Them Eat Chaos, everything.
And what a load of journeys along the way. Again, it's the beauty of writing is that you can be doing multiple things. If something's taking longer, then something else can be going on at the same time. It doesn't have to be, it's 5 years in the making, but it's 5 years.
But it's
also
like,
included some
yeah.
collections, some other, you know,
yeah,
all this
yeah,
kind of
thing.
That's,
it's, I just should just say it's not a folk album.
Yeah,
it's
like, yeah.
He very quickly told us we were wrong there. But it's cool. Like it's a cool position to be in when you say like, well, actually, like, you're extremely legendary, but we really want to do this album, so we'll just do that first.
And that's what's dope as well. What I also like is having someone who you would respect enough to push you so far out of your comfort zone. Because that's what's
mental.
Exciting about this is it sounds like this is an album that you and Dan wouldn't have made.
Definitely
this wouldn't have existed. So it's one of the reasons people like Rick Rubin are so legendary, because they're like, right, no... You can't just go off and make this with anyone else. This is something that wouldn't have existed without him going, that's not it.
Yeah.
That's not it. That's not right.
And
that
he doesn't touch the instruments. He doesn't touch the mixing. It doesn't, all he does, he comes in, he sits down and he listens.
Yeah.
That's all that for like an hour
it's
a day.
It's amazing though.
That's all he does. It's mad.
It's such an underrated thing because it is. It's that everyone always speaks of Miles Davis, but Miles Davis had loads of amazing musicians on every record.
Yeah, 100%.
But it was Miles that brought the best out of all of them. And even if it's just from the vibe, from him being in the room, from his known kind of attitude and almost a meanness or a scariness kind of thing, that brought it out of everyone. And that's why it's his name on the records. That's why, you know, it is everyone else has played their part, but that's what's exciting about someone like Rick Rubin who, he's not going, I've got some beats for you, have a listen.
Yeah, no,
he's going, send me some stuff, I'll tell you if it's shit.
It's been a mad process,
But another thing that was exciting, and again, as we've said on all of this, that recognition or record sales or whatever else. It's not what you're after, but it's nice when it happens if you've done if you've done your own thing, you know, if you've stuck to your guns. And the Mercury nomination was a wicked thing.
Oh, it was amazing.
To happen. Because, again, for someone who's come from spoken word, and the record was rap and spoken words, that kind of, that grey line. And I was excited at the time because what instantly came to mind as well was I looked at the lineup and I was excited first for you. And then I saw Young Fathers on there. And both me and you, unknowing that we were there, went to see Run the Jewels at Brixton Electric. Yeah. And Young Fathers were supporting them.
Yeah.
And we bumped into each other in the smoking area, just exploding with excitement. And it was just the perfect kind of meeting of like, did you see that shit? And we were both like, that's the best thing I've ever seen in my life. Who are those guys? What is this?
Yeah.
You never get that blown away by a support act. It was really this amazing moment. So knowing or feeling a personal connection there with Young Fathers and you as well is beautiful, that you were both in there and you were both on cool labels and pushed in the right way.
Yeah.
So how was all that, to be out there, to be nominated, to go and perform? Like, do you perform at the Mercury's? That's kind of how it works, right?
It's weird, yeah. You like, they've got a revolving stage.
Right.
It's like a proper thing, you know, or one lifts up and the other lifts down. And it was amazing experience. It was all very, for us, it was exciting. I think for other artists, it wasn't as they were a bit more blasé about it, I think. But we were just over the moon. And yeah, it was like live TV, you know, we mucked it up. It was all that stuff that the first time you do it, which is arguably the most important time, is the time when you're least equipped to be able to do that kind of thing.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
When
you're like, you can't control your nerves, you don't. But it was really exciting. Young Fathers, yeah, for me, are like probably the greatest kind of band of our time.
Yeah.
And like, I think, yeah, their new record is fantastic. Like, what they're doing is so kind of punk. And at the same time, just like, it's really straightforward, no nonsense. And they were so chill. Like,
yeah,
we were all like, you know, like just acting like absolute idiots, jumping around because we've been waiting all our lives to like be in a room like that.
Yeah.
Whereas they were a bit more like, this isn't it. This isn't what we want. And this is not what we're doing it for. So I learned a lot from them, actually.
I remember I had them on my radio show like just before their first album came out. So when they only had their mixtapes out, and they were so just, because a lot of people have asked for them to come on the podcast, and I'd like to have them on, but equally, I don't know if they're going to be up for talking for more than 10 minutes, because they are those dudes that are very much,
and
it worked in the end, because on my radio show I was allowed to play what I wanted, so I was playing my favourite songs off their record rather than here's your new single, and I just fluked that the first one that I picked was their favourite song and they wanted it to be the single and it hadn't been made the single. So do you know what I mean? Instantly had that excitement and got that out of them, but it did feel that could have been hard work, because again, that's not what they're doing this for. They're not doing this to do interviews, to win awards. They're doing this to make the art that they make, and they're bloody good at it.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's like, and it's surprising how much of a surprise that is.
Yeah.
When you're like, wow, okay, that's different.
Yeah.
They're like, that's brave. And then you're like, wow, that's how it should be. Like,
completely.
It's really cool, man.
It's interesting you say about the first time you do it is the most important, but when you're the least equipped. I always remember from gigging early days with like Adele and all that lot, I always remember when Adele was doing Jules Holland and there was all this pressure for her to have an orchestra to play with Jules, all this kind of thing. And I'm sure it was Richard Russell at the time or someone at XL just turned around and went, look, this is just going to go wrong.
Yeah.
So they just sat her down with a guitar, and it came after Paul McCartney
and all this huge stuff.
And then it's just a girl with a guitar and she blew everyone away because that's what she's comfortable with.
Yeah.
If they'd tried to go, it's Jules, oh, we need to add this and this, then she would have been nervous because she's like, I'm not used to playing with. It's mad that that's how our minds work as well. All right, it's a big deal, so we need to add tons of elements that you've never worked with before.
Yeah.
That'll make it more relaxing and comfortable rather than doing what you're really good at doing.
Yeah.
Let's add all this craziness.
Yeah.
A question that I was coming up with on the way here, and it's a genuine one that I'm curious on because I don't know the answer. Is there anything that you're into that people wouldn't expect you to be into? Like a TV show, a film, music, anything? Because it made me, I was thinking of it because I was reminiscing of when me, you and Polar Bear did that spoken word tour.
Yeah.
And we, in that van, we would just get drunk and listen to like 90s R&B or soul and funk and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. And it was always that thought of every night we're going on stage and we're being poets. And everyone's looking at how intelligent we are and how powerful and deeply we think. And then we're drinking cheap booze in the van. Polar Bear's legs are coming up and he's doing a little dad dance. And it just always occurred to me, it's like if people had an idea of what we would be doing in our off time, it wouldn't have been that. So is there anything like that with you? Is there any TV shows or...
Yeah, there's loads. Like, obviously, the person that you are on stage is, like, a very specific side of yourself. Like, you know, I'm not at all that intense when I don't have to be. Do you know what I mean? I love to watch, like, trashy TV. I love 90s R&B. I love quite cheesy soul music. I can't, you know, a question like that puts you on the spot suddenly. My mind's just blank. I think, like, what is TV? I mean, the majority of my life off stage is like just pretty goofy and
regular.
Like when I'm hanging out with my people, we have fun, you know, like my family and my friends and my partner. Like, I'm not like always kind of reciting poetry and like reading William Blake and like intensely listening to Gravediggers, like, although I do that often.
It's a bit heavy, right?
It's a bit heavy for, like, you know, summer.
Are you listening to any good new music at the moment? Is there anyone that's caught your ear?
Yeah. There's a rapper that I just found out about called Deem, D-E-E-M. And then is it, like, Marcel, his surname or something? His surname begins with M, but I can't remember. But if you were to search Deem M, you'll find him.
Yeah, it'll come up.
I think he's really interesting. He's a New York rapper, but he reminds me a bit of this poet, Isaiah Hull from Manchester, who I've been like, he's come out to support me a few times. There's something kind of similar. It's quite exciting. Kind of laid back and like a little bit sarcastic. I like him.
Yeah.
And then Confucius MC, who's a rapper that I grew up with, but has just been putting out a couple of EPs recently on Jest's label, which is the name of the label escapes me now, but it's Jest's label, whatever. Confucius MC.
Yeah.
He's brilliant and he's putting stuff out at last, which is brilliant. I think he's streets ahead of himself.
Yeah.
Who else am I listening to? I listen to the New Young Fathers, actually. And, yeah. Oh, Terza. Her thing.
Who's Terza? I don't know.
So that's, it's Mika Levy's production.
Right.
And it's a singer called Terza on the vocals. And it's like kind of grungy R&B. It's, but beautiful love songs. Their album's called Devotion. It'll be out in August. I think it's going to do really well.
Some good shit. So
cool.
Where are you living at the moment? I genuinely hardly listen to any music for some reason these days, but there's been a couple of things this year. I had everyone for years recommending Ocean Wisdom to me, and I was always like, no, I'll listen to it at some point. And then I got his most recent album, and it's blown me away.
Right,
the dude
can
rap like a motherfucker. And having people like Method Man on there, but also a Chester P and Jest and Roots Maneuver and Rodney P, and just all these, there's such a variation of set of sounds and styles on there, yet he seems to steal every song. Like, often the risk is if you've got a lot of guests that they're going to come on and do their one verse and steal it, but he seems to every single time just go, by the way, at the end,
by the way,
just
I'm
rap like
you,
a motherfucker. So I'm loving that, but also this girl, Tierra Whack, I keep going on about.
Tierra Whack, all right.
You'd like her. She's from Philly, and she released this 15-minute music video.
Amazing.
And it's all in one-minute chunks. It's one of the most beautiful, it's with a French director. It's one of the most beautiful visual things I've ever seen. And then it wasn't until I downloaded the album that I realised that that was the whole album. It's 15 one-minute songs.
Wow.
And they're all amazing. They're all beautiful and just...
Is there pauses between the songs? It just plays continuously?
There is pauses. Or the video, it just pretty much plays continuously. Yeah. There's maybe a few different scenes to blend in. But yeah, it's mind-blowing. It blew me away because I then... Again, it's the journey you went... In fact, me and Polar were texting. Because as soon as I found it, I sent it to him and we were texting each other. But then I looked and at the time, her Instagram page... was 15. Instagram is blocks of three, so five rows. Each one was a one-minute video because you can have 1-minute video. So her Instagram page was just her album as well.
Wow.
And it was cool. Genuinely, it's great. And it was cool seeing the restraint. Because a couple of them, you're nodding your head and like, this is a just straight up banger.
And then it stops.
Like, we're done now. It's like, oh, shit. At first you think it'd be amazing to write a load of 1 minute songs, because we all know that the first verse comes naturally as you're writing it. And the second and third are the ones where you're like, right, I'm not at the finishing point yet. So wow. Just go, let's just do these one. But yeah.
That's bold. I like that, yeah.
It blew me away. And it's genuinely, the video reeled me in. Yeah. Because it's this amazing thing, but then I've bumped it just on my phone, just constantly since, just this 15-minute album. And it couldn't be more opposite of Ocean Wisdom, whose album's got like 408 songs on or some shit. It's a proper UK hip-hop tradition of one of them 22, 24-track type albums. But yeah, I'm loving them both.
I'll check them out.
I'll start to wrap things up as I know you need to get off. But I want to talk a little bit about how it was, because last time we spoke, you were in Whitstable slaving away on your novel.
Yeah.
How was it to, because it's kind of a known thing that starting a novel or having an idea for a novel is one of the easiest things imaginable, but completing a novel is one of the hardest things imaginable. So how was that to go through that process to get it completed? And again, to finish with something that was good and that people liked, and you know.
Well, it was the hardest undertaking I had attempted at that point, and it was exhausting, and like I felt really, again, inequipped to be handling it, but at the same time driven by this compulsion to get to the end of this story. I'd been carrying this story around in my head for years and years and years. Characters have popped up in other things. I needed to get it out of me, but I just kept coming up against my own limitations as a writer, my own limitations as a thinker, all the things. Yeah. You know, you've got to create this universe. I think I was telling you that last time we spoke.
Yeah.
But I did finish it, and I was drafting and editing in the back of the tour bus, and like I put the work in. You know, I definitely feel like I went as hard as I could at it. And I thought to myself, okay, now I've got to the end of this. Now I know how this goes. The next one's going to be like a bit easier. But I just think it's like,
it's just not easy.
It, like the, I'm, a, I've been working on a novel for a few months, like, which is the longest I've ever had to work on anything. And as you say, the beginning of it, it's like, oh, this is going to be amazing. It's all coming out. Like you get to about a third of the way in and you hit the first wall and it's just crippling. Suddenly you've got to like pick up every little shred of your brain from wherever you've left bits of it over the course of your life and try and make it work and like develop in all these kind of abstract ways, because you're thinking for so many people and you're hopefully keeping the thread of narrative, plot, character, time, place, date, continuity.
Yeah.
It's just like, I have so much respect for novel. I have respect for everybody in every creative discipline. I really do. And like, and even further, you know, like anyone in these kind of performance related.
Yeah.
Sports people, whatever it is, like facing that, like, how am I going to make it work today? You know, like, how am I going to be able to do this today? Anyone.
Does it help having people to kind of to back you up, to say that you are worthy of this, you are meant to be, you are good at this? It comes to mind because Becky is my literary agent who looks after you as well.
Yeah.
And I had this novel that I'd had in my head for 15 years, and I got a finished draft of it, and I was like, yes.
Oh,
and then,
congratulations.
But it was like a year ago. And then I just lost all my confidence in it.
Yeah.
Like the feedback from the publisher was like, we like it, but this. And at that point, again, as similarly, we're going off doing loads of stuff.
Yeah.
And I had a meeting with them both last week, because that's what you remember, and go, you know it's good, right? And I was like, what? In my mind, the feedback had been, nah, it's not really worth it. But it's because I'd slaved so hard to get to that point, it threw me. And it took an email from Becky this week to go, the publisher's still asking how it's coming along, and I just kind of just put it aside.
But
so
it's a difficult
thing to have people give you that confidence of, no, you can write a novel or a novella or whatever these things turn out to be.
I think like it's an interesting point because editing, like somebody telling you that's not quite working or that bit or that there's something structural isn't right or that character isn't developed, your initial response, because we're used to like going out in front of a crowd and if they like it, it goes really, really well.
Yeah.
And then that's it, finished. But then if someone comes back with feedback, it's kind of hard to believe in yourself that that wasn't them saying it's a flop, it's a failure.
Yeah,
to find the energy to go back and be really intrinsic with it and be like, okay, so I've got to just work really like specifically on these things. It's a whole different craft,
isn't it?
You know?
I mean, that's it. I'm rereading what I'd written at the moment. I was reading on the way here, and instantly I just had this breakthrough moment of I'm now excited again, and I'm now this can be great, and
I'm actually
extending it here and doing this and doing that. But that was something I'd kind of put to bed a little bit because I was like, oh, it didn't work out. I'm still proud of me for getting to where I got with it.
Yeah,
didn't work out. So it is mad how those things can just. Digging
so
you,
how can
in
we
evil
like,
way, in evil way, in someone saying you're good can motivate you to keep going. Equally, someone saying that's not quite right can motivate
can
you to go
make you bottom out completely. Yeah, but how can we turn that out so for people listening? I think that there's something that can be said where whatever the idea is always perfect. The finished thing is always completely flawed. It's never a success. It's 100%. Always a failure. But every time you sit down to write, it's a failure. But actually, it's how you process failure, compute failure, deal with failure that is much more important to you in your development as an artist or a human being than any accolade or success.
And not even as simple as overcome failure. Because it's not even always an overcoming.
Yeah,
it's a coping with. It's a dealing with. It's a moving around and knowing what is in front of you. It's like, right, here's what it is. Here's what we're dealing with rather than anything else.
Every time you write, you fail. Because in itself, it's failure. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's never going to be the idea. You're never going to be able to do that.
I can't remember. I think it must have been on a podcast I recorded. No, it is. It's a line in Hotel Artemis, and I had the director on yesterday.
Wow.
And it's a line, it's a bank robber talking to another bank robber, and he's saying, we deal with the situation we have, not the situation we wanted.
Right.
And that's the most important thing. And he was saying it's key in all art, in everything. Because when you start a project, here's what I wanted it to be.
And then you might find
it's not that. You might get deeper and deeper in and it's something else. And there's nothing wrong with that. But you deal with what you've got rather than what you wanted. And I think that's huge for creativity.
Yeah. It's failing well, isn't it? It's learning how to fail incrementally more successfully than you failed last time.
Well, perfect note to end on. Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me too.
We'll catch up again soon at some point.
Yeah. You've been listening to Scrooby's Picks.
There we go. That was Kate Tempest, a wonderful guest. If you enjoyed this one, then go back and listen to her previous appearance. It was like 2 or 3 years ago. A lot has gone on since, so it's fascinating to kind of compare the two, hear more from her early career in the first episode. Yeah, check that out if you want more of this. Or check out her appearance on James O'Brien's podcast. Yeah. There's loads of Kate Tempest to go about, but most importantly of all, check out Running Upon the Wires, available now in all good bookstores, online, all that kind of thing. Get ordering. I'll be back next week. I've rambled on about that enough at the start. I should mention that we're coming up to the second from last of my club nights of the year. So the We Are Lizards club night is back on September 29th, and we've got Dan Lesac coming down to DJ with us and get Kate Where Kate Fly. So it's an amazing one. It's the night before Progress at Wembley. So yeah, it's going to be pretty. It's going to be rowdy. You might want to pre-order your tickets online. You can buy tickets online on pre-order at the Book Club's website, or you can put your name on the guest list to guarantee entry. And that is by sending names to info@thetrashsociety.com. That email address is manned by Stu Whiffin of the Hardcore Listening podcast, so feel free to sling some insults about his potato head. And yeah, also again to mention I've set up a Patreon. As you will have heard in this episode, when Kate asked me about the podcast, I told two stories of why podcasts mean the world to me and why I want to be able to keep doing this. And talking to Kate really kind of slapped me around the face, because I get excited about big name guests when they come my way. I almost had a Batista recently. Again, if the right big name guests come along, I'm still going to have them. That's all I've ever done. I was excited to speak to Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy and Lena Headey and Simon Pegg and all these people. But equally, the ones that when Kate asked me that and I look back, the ones that mean the world to me are the ones that aren't big name guests. And that's what I like to do. I continue to do. As I've mentioned, I've got a guest coming up who's an amazing, a young lady with a robotic arm. And that excites me. And yeah, it's cool. Anyway, no, I told you there's no hard sell. The only option is to pledge $1 a month. It's 80p a month, essentially. If that, it might come up as 70p. I don't know. I can't remember the exchange rates. So yeah, patreon.com/ScroobiusPip, I guess. Or just go to Patreon and search ScroobiusPip. You'll see there's a picture of me. There's a background picture of me as well, which is a picture I've never posted anywhere, I don't think. So that's exciting. And yeah, it explains it all there. It gives you the option to give me a dollar. And that's that. Okie doke, I will see you all next week. Thank you for tuning in. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.